Good morning again. If you have your Bibles with you, I encourage you to turn them to 2 Timothy 1, 5 through 7. And before we hear this passage this morning, I'm just going to tell you a little bit about it. 2 Timothy is one of those books, one of those letters in the New Testament called the pastoral letters, because they were written from a pastor to a community. They are 1 and 2 Timothy and Titus, and they all have these very practical instructions to the church on how to live in the world. Now, for a lot of people and for a lot of Bibles, it'll say Paul's letter to Timothy, the second letter of Paul, the first letter of Paul. But most theories of authorship nowadays point to an author from the Pauline school, but not from Paul. There are too many things in the letter that Paul would have known anything about that weren't really reflective of what Paul represented in the rest of his letters that we know are authentic. Vocabulary, theology, circumstances are more akin to a letter writer that knows something about bishops. Paul didn't know from bishops. There were no bishops when Paul was alive and writing. He was talking about maybe deacons and the development of a later first century church that's trying to organize itself after the destruction of the temple and Christians were trying to find their way separate from their Jewish roots. And so if you read any of the early church fathers, and they've got great names like Polycarp and things like that. If you read Polycarp or First Clement or anything like that, you're going to find a striking resemblance to what you read here. And these guys were writing much, much later. So when you're listening to Timothy, think Polycarp, etc. Now, the setting is, though, from Paul. I mean, whoever wrote this was writing as if they were Paul, writing from prison, and it really has just one message, and that is encouragement to endure. The whole letter is about endurance, no matter what you face. And this passage is especially good on Mother's Day because the writer is speaking with confidence about Timothy's faith based on what he learned from his grandmother and his mother, both of whom were strong women. And they passed their faith on to him. And so I know in my case, and I think in many people's cases that I talk to, it's the women in our lives, our mothers and our grandmothers, that really take a special effort to try and pass the faith on to the children. And so I think that's been going on for 2,000 years plus. So listen to this passage from an unknown author writing to Timothy saying, hang on, don't forget what your grandmother and your mother taught you about your faith.
I am reminded of your sincere faith, the faith that lived first in your grandmother Lois and your mother Eunice, and now, I am sure, lives in you. For this reason, I remind you to rekindle the gift of God that is within you through the laying on of my hands. For God did not give us a spirit of cowardice, but rather a spirit of power and of love and of self-discipline. Hear what the Spirit is saying to the church.
Let's pray. Loving Spirit, we are grateful for these words of wisdom that come to us from so early in our tradition. May your Spirit be upon us as we this day consider those words of encouragement in our lives and the challenge to endure that which is before us and that which has been modeled to us. We gather as followers of Jesus. Amen. Well, something a little different for this week. It has become something of an every other year tradition or so that I read you a story on Mother's Day from one of my favorite really messed up mothers, which is Anne Lamott. I'm going to read a passage to you today from her book called Traveling Mercies, and the chapter is just called Mom, and it's in the section called Fambly. Now, some of you know Anne Lamott. She's a dreadlocked, drug-recovering alcoholic. She writes with ruthless honesty and humor about all sorts of subjects that usually begin with capital letters, things like alcohol, alcoholism, motherhood, Jesus, and she writes about what most of us don't like to think about, things like pain and death and struggle, side by side with joy, renewal, and hope. I mean, she tells her stories with an honesty and a compassion that, for me at least, and I know talking to many of you, she is got this uncanny ability to make you be able to laugh and cry, sometimes in the same sentence. So she's the author of all sorts of books, including Hard Laughter, All New People, and this one, Traveling Mercies. This is a collection of kind of autobiographical stories about her faith. As I said, this one is on Mom, and the whole chapter is way too long, so I'm just going to be reading some excerpts. And for any of you that are familiar with Lamott, I'm also going to be altering some of the language so that it's a little more PG for church, just a little. So here's your chance to do what you're seldom encouraged to do during the sermon, which is you can close your eyes and not have to defend yourself that you're just resting your eyes, that you're listening. And I'm going to come up because I'm going to read a story to you. So are you ready? This is Mom. An old friend took a photograph of my mother and me on Stinson Beach this year on the 4th of July. We're holding hands in the picture, as in fact we were doing all day, because my mom feels unsteady walking on sand. She's in her mid-70s now, short and round, with big brown eyes and cropped gray hair that used to be black and stream down her back like lava. In the photo, I'm looking over at her with enormous gentleness because I sometimes feel this. Some part of me in Odysseus's dog, but I was only feeling this about half the time that day. The rest of the time, I was annoyed. I was annoyed in general because she is not at all whom I would have picked at the Neiman Marcus Mommy Salon. I would have chosen someone tall, elegant, and physical. I would have chosen someone with a ferocious belief in herself and God and me. I would have chosen someone who did not give a damn what other people thought of her or her children. I would have chosen someone who refused, with incredulity, to be the Sherpa for any man's hatred of his mother. Specifically, I think I was annoyed that day because she acts so much older than she is. She's only 73, but she staggers along in the sand like a toddler. I was annoyed because she had asked me once again with anxious hope if I had met anyone nice. I was also annoyed because dark pink lipstick was smeared on her front teeth. I was annoyed when I went to pick her up because she had taped even more photographs of my father to the wall, although they had been divorced for years by the time he died after a long and disappointing marriage. I was annoyed because we were waiting for my younger brother and my son to meet us at the beach for a 4th of July party at a friend's house, and each time my brother's name was even mentioned, my mother acted like a Frank Sinatra fan. Also, she is so needy. She needs me to pull her to her feet when she's been sitting down, needs to grip my hand tightly when she walks as though we're on a tightrope instead of a beach. She needs me to retrieve her lipstick from inside our friend's house. Her smile already looks like a distant Tahitian sunset. Also, I secretly believed she could do better if she tried. That, perhaps this sounds paranoid, she acts this way to torture and control me. In my worst moments, I imagine her at home just before I pick her up, wearing a telephone headset and berating some commodities trader. Then when she hears me knock, she dashes to her bedroom, stashes the headset, pulls on her Ruth Buzzy cardigan, applies lipstick to her teeth, and totters to the front door to let me in. On the beach, I hold her hand, and I feel that my heart could break with love for her. 10 minutes later, I find myself growling at her when she's out of earshot, when she's sitting on the sand waiting for me to return with her lipstick. I have become a person of growl. Sometimes, holding her soft, warm hand, I want to take it and hurl it to the sand beneath the wheels of the oncoming lifeguard's Jeep. Oh, God, the trust with which she keeps holding it out for me to take. Without someone to steady her, she cannot find her balance. And I guess when you take away the resentment and disappointment, it's that simple. It's what we do in families. We help because we were helped. Now, when I look at that picture taken on the 4th, my stomach aches with a miserable sort of poignancy, because she is so friendly and eager to please. For just this moment, I look like I am in love with her and she with me. For this one moment, we are. I'm learning very slowly to savor the minutes between us that work, that cut through my lifelong hunger for the perfect mother. In the photograph, both of us look our very best. My mother looks like all the good things she is: kind, highly intelligent, pretty, with gentle eyes and smooth, fair skin. But you can also see in her gaze the need to please, the need of an elderly woman for people to see that she is a very good girl. She used to wear a mask of makeup, so she didn't always seem as vulnerable as she does now. The makeup seemed to hold her together somehow. Now she's like cells in the process of division, which haven't yet settled back into place. I think this is why the lipstick on her teeth bothers me. It tells the whole world, I tried, I missed, I have no idea it's there. We walk a little further in the sand. My mother sees things in the sand she wants. A sand dollar, sea glass, shells. And she points to them like she's the queen mother. I swoop down in a plié to pick them up for her. I know she misses the beaches of Hawaii more than she lets on, the sun and her friends in Honolulu. She has pictures of them on her living room wall. She's sitting with them on the patio at the yacht club, playing bridge under a beach umbrella, and in their company, she looks like she has finally landed back on her home planet. There's nothing more touching to me than a family picture where everyone is trying to look his or her best, but you can see what a mess they all really are. Frozen in the amber of the photograph, you can see all the connections and disconnections, the stress and the yearning, and you can see the pride in their lineage, in that big bottom lip, say, that went from grandma to dad to baby. It's there on their faces for all to see. And you can see how they love it, that big lip. It is their immortality. There are pictures of people in my family where we look like the most awkward and desperate folk you ever saw. Poster children for the human condition. But I like that when when who we are shows. Everything is usually so masked or perfumed or disguised in the world. And it's so touching when you get to see something real and human. I think that's why most of us stay close to our families, no matter how neurotic the members, how deeply annoying or dull. Because when people have seen you at your worst, you don't have to put on the mask as much. And that gives us license to try on that radical hat of liberation, the hat of self-acceptance. We're allowed to escape from underneath one of the fatwas. The friend who took the picture of my mom and me on that beach is 50 or so and utterly devoted to her big family. Once she was showing me some of her own family pictures, and in one of them, she is eating soup at the kitchen table with her daughter, who lives in a homeless shelter in San Francisco, who drinks and is almost feral now, and is furious with her mother, although she accepts the $1,000 a month her mom gives her for expenses. The mother and daughter have the same mouths, but different eyes. The mother's small and brown, the daughter's so pale blue that you wonder if they were darker until all that booze washed the dyes away. We study the picture together. "Tell me what you see when you look at this," I say. "I see love like she's under my roof, drinking my soup. I see love like she's warm, and we're talking like human beings. I see love like we are two survivors on a leaky boat together, wrapped in dry blankets." I used to carry a picture of myself in my purse, taken by my mother when I was 3. I'm all dressed up in my mother's long, fancy gloves, and I seem very spaced out. My mother caught perfectly the soft, inward face of the 3-year-old girl, marveling at her good fortune, in ecstasy over her lacy gloves. I like to open my wallet and see the child I used to be, who was not used to facing the world. I like to see the sensuous baby face bathed in wonder, looking out at me. In our family pictures, all through the years of my parents' tense marriage, we look like we've seen sorrow, with faces that are sweet and sad and bleak and glazed. There are many pictures of my mother where she has made herself as beautiful as she can be. She has gathered all her pride around her, and the pride of her family is in her family. I used to look through our photo albums and wish that we were one of those families who got their family pictures taken on ski vacations or on the beach in Hawaii or even in studios with painted clouds on the backdrop as if the family had been lowered down in front of it and could be lifted back again en masse when the photograph was done. Steve and Sam were late getting to the beach, and I felt abandoned by them. Stuck with my mother, alone, while they were having God knows what kind of great fun. But as we learned later, Sam had gotten bitten by a yellow jacket in Bolinas across the channel from where my mom and I were waiting. Well, finally, Steve and Sam arrived at Stinson. And you would have thought that they were the entire Supreme Court for the fuss that my mother made. My brother is very gentle and easygoing. He always got along with both parents, but still, my mother's total joy at seeing him fills me with resentment. When I arrived to pick her up that morning, she'd glance down at her watch as if I were terribly late. I was right on time. Plus, she was wearing her worst sweater, and she kept it on in the car, even though the day was warm. "Nana," Sam calls out when he sees my mother. We were sitting on the sand by then. "I got bit by a yellow jacket." She gapes at him, makes sympathetic noises, admires the bite as if it were a bullet hole. "I didn't hardly cry," he tells her. "He was hysterical," my brother whispers to me. She holds out her hands for my brother and me to pull her to her feet. She's still wearing that horrible cardigan, and the day is even hotter now. But I understand all of a sudden that my family is like this old sweater. It keeps unraveling. But then someone figures out how to sew it up one more time. It has lumps, and then it unravels again. But you can still wear it, and it still keeps away the chill. Besides, who made me the keeper of my mother's thermostat? My mother turns to Sam. "Let's go for a walk," she says. He doesn't want to. He always wants to race to the shore and just plunge in. But he's glad to be with her. The fact that she's wearing a sweater does not seem to annoy him. I watch carefully. I tell you, families are definitely the training ground for forgiveness. At some point, you pardon the people in your family for being stuck together in all their weirdness. And when you can do that, you can learn to pardon anyone, even yourself, eventually. It's like learning to drive an old car with a tricky transmission. If you can master shifting gears on that, you can learn to drive anything. I keep watching. Sam takes his grandmother's hand. I feel like sobbing with grief that my mother is old, that she won't always be around, and with despair at what an erratic daughter I am. But it's not a big deal to Sam. He just wants to help her find her balance.